Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, a court ruling on the Road Traffic Management Corporation's chief executive officer's suspension exposes troubling gaps in governance at state entities. Car buyers flock to cheaper models as affordability drives South Africa's strongest new vehicle sales in a decade. A new national database aims to restore trust and transparency in South Africa's small charity sector. And why many loyalty programs fail and how technology may be distracting companies from what really motivates people. It's Monday, the 16th of March. A court ruling declaring the precautionary suspension of the chief executive officer of the Road Traffic Management Corporation unlawful has, I think, exposed what some governance experts say is a serious structural flaw in how certain state entities are run. Now, the court found that the RTMC board did not actually have the delegated authority to suspend the chief executive despite serious allegations including fraud, corruption and wasteful expenditure reportedly having been raised by a whistleblower. Now the case raises uncomfortable questions about whether boards in some public entities have enough power to hold executives accountable or whether the governance model itself is fundamentally broken. Let's put that to Pami Nantasun, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of Directors in South Africa. Pami, a very warm welcome. Let's start with the basics, if we can. A court says the board did not have the authority to suspend its own Chief Executive Officer. From a governance perspective, then, how serious is that finding?
Yes, thanks, Jeremy. Certainly very serious. You know, firstly, if you look at the court finding, I think if we had to test it, it's probably technically correct in terms of what the enabling legislation says. So this board clearly did not have the power to suspend the CEO. But that doesn't mean the enabling legislation itself is without flaw. And I think that's where the problem sits, is how can you have an organization that has a board? This board has duties and responsibilities towards this organization, some of which are legal duties and responsibilities, which could attract potential risk and liability for these board members. But then their hands are almost hamstrung in terms of what they are able to do in order to fulfill their duties. I think this creates a significant governance problem.
Am I being too simplistic when I suggest to you that this effectively means management is no longer accountable to the board in this particular instance?
It would seem so. Now, in a typical governance structure, your shareholders appoint your directors, and your directors then appoint management, which the CEO is a part of. And the directors are responsible for holding management accountable. In this instance, we've got this peculiarity of what they're calling a shareholder committee in between the shareholders and the board, is my understanding. And the shareholder committee decides what is delegated down to the board. In this saying that they didn't delegate the board's ability to suspend the CEO, for example. Another example I read is that at some point when the board defended themselves, the board charter enables them to hold the CEO accountable, they were told that this shareholder committee didn't delegate the approval of a board charter either to the board. So what exactly is the board allowed to do and what are they not allowed to do?
Well, let me ask you this then. Beyond the Road Traffic Management Corporation, in good governance practice, including King Five, who should ultimately have authority then over the appointment and perhaps more importantly, the discipline of any chief executive?
The board should, and that's in terms of the King reports as well. As I mentioned, in terms of the governance structure. And I think what happens often in the public sector, which we see, is that because the shareholders wield a lot of power, and because some of the legislation in the public sector, including some of these enabling acts, allow the shareholders to appoint not only the board, which is fine, but also then the CEO. What that does is it ultimately makes the CEO extremely powerful and feel like they have the shareholders' support and therefore don't need to act as though they are accountable to the board themselves.
And practically, what would that mean on a day-to-day operation, that the board is simply sidelined then?
It would seem so in this instance. I mean, if a board can't take action against, you mentioned it in your opening, serious misconduct allegations, including fraud, corruption, and wasteful expenditure, if they're meant to receive these sorts of complaints and then not have the power to do anything about it, one would almost wonder who would accept such a board position. And I think this is one of the reasons why these public sector board positions become unattractive to experienced directors, because ultimately you don't have the power to exercise your duties and responsibilities, but still sit with potential risk and liability.
So if that power then either wanes or doesn't exist at all, what does it mean in terms of risk and liability?
You know, that's a very difficult question, because the structure is, it's very interesting. I haven't come across this shareholder committee one often. More times than not, you'll have government being the shareholder appointing the board, board appointing management, or the shareholder appointing management, depending on what the legislation says, but still the board having overall oversight and accountability for the CEO in terms of performance and holding the individual accountable. In this instance, with the shareholder committee, it's difficult for me to understand where the ultimate sort of accountability lies.
We've seen governance failures across a number of state entities over a number of years. Is this case then a signifier, in your opinion, to bigger, deeper structural problems in how public entities are set up? And Palmi, if the answer is yes, how do you start rechanging or recalibrating that?
So I think in general, there's a sense that there's very much a lack of people being held accountable, and very much a lack of consequences for certain behavior. And time and time again, you know, there are various allegations and even findings at times, but it feels to us as the public like no one is really held accountable and aren't really clear consequences. In terms of how it gets fixed, I think a lot of it has to do with, firstly, fixing the structures, so being very clear on the role of the shareholder versus role of the board versus role of management in the public sector, really getting that role clarity and aligning what our enabling legislation say to what good governance is in terms of the King reports. And then secondly, of course, most importantly as well, is who we appoint to these various positions. So do we have a shareholder, as in a minister or a government representative, who understands what their role is as shareholder and doesn't go beyond that and impede the board's ability to do their job? And then do we have the proper people being appointed to the boards and then equally to management, understanding exactly what their role is and being committed and willing to fulfill it?
And that's absolutely critical. It's the committed and willing, because as you said a little earlier, if experienced directors feel they can't exercise real authority, this is going to discourage competent professionals from serving, particularly on public entity boards. Just to translate that, maybe we simply just need tougher, more independent directors here, don't we?
Yes, we do. And then an environment that they can operate well in.
So do you think this particular case, Palmi, might force government to revisit the governance framework for state entities?
No, Jeremy, it's difficult to tell, because we've made various commentaries, we've seen various examples over many, many years, and not much has changed. And so it's difficult to tell whether this one will make an impact. I guess we will wait and see.
Thank you very much indeed. Palmi Natarajan, Chief Executive Officer, the Institute of Directors in South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa has just recorded its strongest new car sales in more than a decade, with over 422,000 passenger vehicles sold last year. All well and good. But beneath that headline recovery, the market, I think, appears to be shifting in important ways. Buyers are becoming a lot more price sensitive. Chinese manufacturers, and we've reported on this in full in the past, are rapidly gaining market share. Younger consumers, interestingly, are also driving demand, while premium buyers may be pulling back a little. And I think the important question is whether this is a genuine recovery for the motor industry or simply a structural reset around affordability. Let's bring into the conversation Aisha Hatia, who's Senior Director of Research and Consulting at TransUnion Africa. Welcome, Aisha. Thank you very much indeed. So that headline number looks strong, but how much of this is real recovery and how much is simply pent-up demand after the years of pandemic?
So I do think it's a little bit of both. We do see that pent-up demand. I mean, we're talking about record high sales in quarter four with over 114,000. It was the highest quarterly volume we saw since 2014. So that is sort of a massive recovery from a sales perspective and from an origination perspective. We did see quite low volumes, post-COVID. It took very long for us to recover. So 2025 has been the first year actually seeing that rebound in sales.
You argue, and this makes perfect sense, that affordability is now the biggest driver of sales. But are you able to push that out a little for me? What exactly is changing in how South Africans calculate whether they can afford a new car or not?
So there's a couple of factors that play into what consumers are buying and in what sectors they're buying. So if we're looking at some of the other figures that we're seeing through that come through, there is been a shift between the demand for new cars versus used cars. So that ratio that we normally calculate in terms of used versus new, that has declined. So more people are actually buying new cars over used cars. And that's where these new entrants and the Chinese markets play that role, because where consumers previously were buying secondhand cars because of the affordability, they're looking at paying a little bit extra and getting a new car. And with that new car comes a service plan, it comes with warranty. So it does give consumers that additional peace of mind when doing that purchases. So along with that affordability, they're also considering those additional costs that might arise between choosing a used versus a new car.
And that's very interesting, that narrowing gap between new and used cars. So we prefer new vehicles as what I'm hearing you say, simply
Correct.
Because financing is making them look more affordable on a monthly basis. But is that accurate?
So what consumers are also doing, there is a lot of things that we need to consider again, right? So from a consumer perspective, when they're choosing the new car might be slightly more expensive. Again, they're making considerations around that total cost when it comes to servicing and warranties. What they might be not fully considering is the financing cost that comes along that. So what we see, what's happening is there's an extension of loans. So consumers are taking loans over longer periods. They're also taking bigger balloon payments, which then also affects that total cost of ownership. And that might be something that consumers do need to pay a little bit more attention to, because ultimately they're looking at their wallet in the short term. So yes, we're saving on servicing costs. Yes, we get a warranty. Yes, my installment might be lower because I've extended those terms. But ultimately, that total cost over the life cycle of the vehicle will increase.
And it's that balloon payment often at the end of the cycle that can, to extend the metaphor, really burst the bubble, right?
Correct. Because a lot of consumers at that point then have to rely on the residual value of the vehicle, or they have to be able to refinance those balloon payments at the end of term.
I want to talk about the Chinese brands. If I read your survey correctly, more than 17% of new vehicle sales. That's pretty impressive. Is it simply about price, or do you think consumers are starting to trust these brands in ways that they maybe didn't 3 or 4 years ago?
So we are seeing that structural shift towards that affordability-driven buying. So they do come in with quite aggressive pricing. They do have enhanced specification, extended warranties, and they are building that trust within consumers. Ultimately, consumers are weighing up the options in terms of, if they have to choose alternate brands, what does that mean from an affordability perspective, and what are they getting? So what are those bells and whistles that they're getting? And we're seeing that many of these Chinese manufacturers offer them too.
So what do you think that means for traditional brands that South Africans like, for instance, Toyota, Volkswagen, Ford, if Chinese manufacturers, as your numbers suggest, are growing 9 times faster than the market?
I think there is a place for them. I think they do have brand loyalty. We're seeing that with specifically with the upper-end millennials as well as the Gen Xs. But also they do offer, certain buying incentives that they build into their current campaigns. And if you look at our current volumes right now, they still hold the top 5 volumes within the sales numbers that we're seeing currently. So they do definitely still have quite strong demand. They are still pushing very strong volumes. I think what we're seeing coming from the Chinese brands is perhaps perhaps a new market of consumers, to your earlier point, that had that pent-up demand that wasn't quite ready to enter the market. But the market for our traditional brands is still there. We are seeing their growth. And as I said, if you look at the top 10, our top five is made up of those traditional brands.
Interesting to draw that comparison, though, between Gen X, Gen Z and millennials, and then perhaps older, higher income buyers. Demand among that cohort seems to be cooling. Is that a sign maybe that the premium market is reaching saturation?
I wouldn't say saturation, but we can see that it's starting to normalize, you know, as the demand is shifting back towards those younger affordability conscious consumers. So there is still the, I mean, your luxury brands like BMW is also doing still really well in terms of getting into that premium led demand that still exists in the market.
Let me put this to you, though, and it's against the backdrop of what's happening in the Middle East. Vehicle affordability ultimately depends on interest rates and obviously fuel prices. Oil, again, spiking above $100 a barrel as we have this conversation. Aisha, let me suggest to you that the recovery that we've been talking about is very vulnerable if either of those move sharply again.
Correct. And I think that's what we're all sort of keeping our eye on. You know, even after our finance minister did the budget speech, and the very next day he had to go back and say, yes, it was good and we're all happy. And we, you know, we're trying to figure out what that means for all of us. But that continuously changes. So we have to keep sort of our pulse on the dial. We have to understand what those moving parts are and the impact that it's going to have. So even as we're purchasing these vehicles, we're thinking short-term affordability, but we also need to consider, you know, can I afford the car if the interest rate goes up? Can I afford the car if the petrol goes up? What kind of buffers do I have in place in my wallet and in my pocket to help sort of prevent that shock that might come?
Well, keeping her pulse on the dial for us, that's Aisha Hatia, who's Senior Director of Research and Consulting at TransUnion Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa, as you well know, has thousands of small charities doing vital and important work in communities, but donors often struggle to know which organizations they can actually trust. It's a fair point. Concerns about transparency, governance, and the fragmentation of the nonprofit sector mean that many donors either give cautiously or, worse, not at all. Now, an initiative is trying to tackle that problem head on by creating a public database designed to identify credible grassroots organizations and help give those donors greater confidence about where their money goes. In that respect, I want to talk to Jamie Nye, who's Chief Executive Officer and Trustee of Helpmore. It's an organization that links donors and charities. Jamie, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. Maybe let's start with the core problem, if we can. Why is it so difficult for donors in this country to know whether a charity is trustworthy?
Hello, Jeremy. Thank you for having me on the show. What we found is there is just a huge lack of trust in South Africa when it comes to any financial matters because of the high levels of corruption and fraud that unfortunately happen in our country. And when offenders are caught out, there's very little consequence for them. So this extends to the charity sector, where people need to trust that if they're going to give some of their hard-earned money to charity, that it is going to go where it's intended. And we would like to shine a light on the good guys doing the great work in South Africa to encourage people to support them.
We're going to talk about this trust index in just a moment. But as I understand it, then a lot of people say they want to give, but the problem is they don't know where the money actually ends up. And that is a huge barrier to doing good, that lack of transparency that you refer to, right?
Absolutely. That is the core thinking behind us launching the Trust Index.
So the index aims to solve that problem. Jamie, in practical terms then, how does it work? What does a charity have to prove before it's allowed onto the index?
So the Helpmore Trust Index has been launched as a platform to showcase a gold standard in the SA charity space. It's free to list. Anybody can list. And then we assess the proposed charities on a 10-star criteria based on governance, financial transparency, their impact, and also their media footprint, which is also really important for telling the great stories that they're doing. These many amazing organizations make an essential, compassionate, and ethical difference to our society, so we champion them. And we hope this will lead to further support that people can trust they know where their money is going and that it is making the intended impact. You know, in SA, there isn't even a way to verify if a charity is legitimate, let alone go deep into their finances and see how the donors' funds are spent. So in this regard, we strongly encourage all charities to publish their current audited financials online, creating more transparency and building trust. And people can look at the listings on our site and they can access directly their financial statements and go through them as they wish. Another big gray area that we have found is what amounts are paid for salaries in nonprofits. Everybody working for an organization definitely needs to get paid. They all have rent and food and life bills to cover. And if they aren't paid, they're not going to stick around for long. But these salaries need to be reasonable, especially in light of being a nonprofit. To tackle this, we ask charities to disclose their lowest and highest salaries in the organization, and we publish this information on their Trust Index listing. It's a very interesting data point and one not viewable by going through the financials. You'll just see one number for salaries for the whole organization, not specifics. For example, we had a big charity that feeds thousands of people around the country, does great work, and they applied to list. And looking at their data, it said the lowest salary was 6K, but the highest salary was 265K a month. I asked them if this was a typo, not 26,500 Rand a month, and they confirmed, nope, it is correct. This is six times the average of a decent salary in the sector for sort of a CEO of an organization. And as a result, we could not in good faith include them in the trust index. That donor grant money is intended for and should be going in the majority to the beneficiaries they advertise are in such need.
That's astonishing. I mean, forgive me as I pick myself up off the floor after hearing that number. No. Jamie, who actually performs the due diligence and how rigorous is your process?
We have an accountant, Doe, who goes through the information. He fact checks them. He checks the certificates. He checks the registrations. And most of the bigger organizations are fairly well governed and have all this information available. And the ones that it isn't as publicly available, we call them and we check and see. We have to make sure that those we are saying are reputable are in fact doing so. And there is a lot of fraud in the sector. There are many ECD, early childhood development centers that don't have any kids in them. And they take grant money and they take donor money and they get a bunch of kids together and take a few photos. And people, it's like a job, you know, but they're not doing the work, but they're getting paid. So we're trying to cut through that a bit.
Jamie, not to detract from the work that you're doing, but critics might say that you're creating a two-tier charity system where organizations not on your list are immediately viewed with suspicion. Is that unfair?
Yeah, I think it is unfair because all we're doing is we're pushing for transparency. If you're doing good work, you should have nothing to hide. You know, you shouldn't have an issue with people looking through your financials because you are a non-profit company working for public benefit. So all we're doing is creating more transparency and less opaqueness, less gray areas where people then lose trust. We also support the smaller charities. So we have two tiers to what we do with Helpmore. We have the Trust Index, which is sort of the gold standard. But then we directly invest in grassroots charities ourselves, the smaller ones that maybe wouldn't get the 8 or the 10 star listing on the index. We supply funding, we supply resources, we build websites for them. We have a social media team that trains and helps them get their social media up and running. Plus many other ways, every project's different in their needs. We currently have 18 projects that we support in South Africa, and we keep adding more that align with the goals of Helpmore.
Finish your thought.
So it becomes like kind of like an incubation hub. You know, we take these grassroots charities that are struggling, and we give them some breakthrough funding. It's unrestricted funding. We don't benchmark or ring fence anything. And we essentially invest in the founders running these small organizations and often provide the salary that they have never got, which allows them to focus more fully on the organization. We help them get all their ducks in a row with registrations, payment platforms, transparency, and that will get them up to a 7, 8, 9 or even 10 star listing on the Trust Index. So there is a sort of a pathway for the smaller ones.
Jamie, just a final question, and you referenced some of the charity scandals that have occurred over the past couple of years. If a charity listed on your index later fails your standards, do you simply remove them, or is there some form of public accountability?
We will first contact them to check why they have fallen short and see if there are any remedies that we can help them to rectify it, because at the end of the day, it's better for the country as a whole. The more NGOs working, the better. But if it's not fixable, we remove them off the index.
Jamie Nye, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, Trustee of Helpmore.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, loyalty programs have become a massive part of modern business, promising personalized rewards, digital engagement, and ever more sophisticated data. But despite all the technology and platforms now available, I think many programs still struggle with one simple problem. People sign up, ask yourself if you've done that, but we don't stay engaged. Some experts suggest the reason is that companies have become so focused on the technology behind the loyalty programs, they're actually forgetting the human behavior they are meant to influence. Let's discuss that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Andrew Solomon, Marketing Director at the Achievement Awards Group. Andrew, a very warm welcome. Let's start with a central point. Companies investing heavily in loyalty and incentive programs, yet the engagement, as you're going to tell me, is often disappointingly low. What's the issue here? What's the disconnect?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. Yeah, the problem is the focus, right? So the focus is on the technology as if it is going to solve the problem. So you're going to find a lot of what we talk about today is kind of getting back to where should the focus be. And so the principle of what I'm trying to say and remind people of is that innovation in this kind of space, or in fact in any space, is not actually to do with technology. It's to do with thinking.
Loyalty programs originally grew out of behavioral insight rather than technology, but the script has been flipped. Why do you think companies have lost sight then of the original principle?
So I think that because technology has come at us at such speed, and it actually offers incredible benefits. If you think merely about the amount of data, we all hear about the amount of data that exists based on our own profiles, our own individual profiles with any number of retailers and businesses, brands, et cetera. And that's all possible because of how data and the collection of data and certainly the storage and accessibility of that data have been enabled over the past decade, two decades, et cetera, in the advent of initially of the internet and then so many more things since then. But it's because it's been so available and so easy to implement, easy, relatively speaking. Obviously, we're talking about fairly large organizations. Mm. But I think it's that easiness that kind of betrays the effectiveness of it. It's not to be assumed that just because you're collecting data, that you're using it correctly. For example, just to stick with that example.
But it's so interesting because so many of the programs that I've seen rely on either huge reward catalogs, great point systems, and the hyper-personalized messaging I think has got better. Yet they're still failing to create real loyalty. Do you think maybe there are just too many of these programs around that we're just very confused and perhaps over-inundated?
Yes, I think that's a great point, Jeremy. And you know, the choice is an interesting thing for us mere mortals. You know, there's many studies, marketing studies that have been done, you know, as long ago as the 70s, where when faced with a lot of choice, we actually don't take action. We're not motivated to take action and to do the necessary next step. And I think similar things exist with regard to loyalty programs and the kind of the choices of where to go. And especially when all of the offerings and outcomes are fairly similar, and none of the loyalty programs tend to stand out because they all use typically the same technology. They're farming data, they're using it, as you say, personalized, hyper-personalized. They know this time of day you walk into the coffee shop and you do that, and so you get an SMS, etc. But because we have so much choice, we actually almost move to inaction, and then it starts becoming about just convenience. Is that coffee shop just 10 meters away as opposed to 50 meters away? Whereas in the beginning of all of this, people would go out of their way. True loyalty is when people go out of their way and engage with that brand because it's going to do something for them emotionally, or there's going to be a reward, etc. So it's not just the rewards where when you have too much choice, it's actually meaningless. But it's also, I think, the kind of the choice of loyalty program, the choice of who am I going to give my attention to.
So, Andrew, tell me this then. If a loyalty program isn't working properly, are there specific signals then that a business should be looking out for?
I mean, you've said it earlier, is engagement. Engagement is one of the kind of the moments of truth when you talk about people signing up. Very often there's this phenomenon of people signing up at the till point, and because they want to get a deal, you often the person at the counter is encouraged to say, "Are you part of the program? If you do it, you do this, you'll sign up and you'll get 100 rand off that jacket or whatever it is." And people will sign up, but that's not engagement. Mm. And then certainly it doesn't play out in ongoing engagement. And part of, in fact, a big thing we're speaking about here is the strategy of the loyalty program, right? So yes, they've got the technology, they've able to give the discount, the person walked away, they had a reasonably good experience, they benefited from that. And you could fool yourself, you were the brand, into thinking, well, we got a great sign-up rate. But when you look at the following kind of engagement rates, there's one of those moments of truth where you go, oh my gosh, we've got a problem here, we need to sort this out.
So it's about instant self-gratification, which comes initially, but as my late father always used to say, young man, it's all about the follow-up or the follow-through, and that then defaults to psychology. How do you get that side of the equation right, do you think?
Yeah, so your father was exactly right. The follow-up is the most important thing, because essentially that's the first part of creating that loop, right? So we've all, you know, read books on forming good habits, etc. And this is essentially the same kind of science, is that there's a kind of a habit loop where you're taking an action, getting a reward, considering a kind of an either state of discomfort or a challenge, and then you go back to the action to get the reward. So that ultimately is what people need to build. And this has gotten very little to do with technology, as it were. It's got a lot to do with the thinking around human psychology. What are people like today? What are the different generations needing? What are the trigger points of different kind of personality types? What are the trigger points of your particular customer? Which is very easy, ironically, for a small business owner to do, who's sitting behind the counter, perhaps the owner themselves is at the front of the store, and they recognize, oh, there's Jeremy. I remember you came in last Friday and you were looking for this, that, and the other, and they'll help you personally. But what we're talking about, Jeremy, is brands with a million customers. Mm. You know, so it's how do you do that? How do you have that level of empathy and personalization to the point where I know it's Jeremy and he lives up the road and he comes here on a Friday because it's on the way, it's the drive home from work or whatever. How do you do that at scale? And it's the thinking, it's the strategy, it's the being able to unpick and understand the data so that you can implement what are these behavioral loops.
I am so glad I just ask questions for a living and I don't actually have to do any of this stuff. Andrew Solomon, thank you very much indeed from the Achievement Awards Group. Appreciate your time today. And that's our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.